Chapter 15, A Little Fame. That's when you moved to the Regency House, right, Norm? Yes, that's right, Adam Egan. Remember the Regency House? Makes me kind of sad remembering. They say my father's house has many mansions, but the one I live in now is no great digs. Four men to a room, and you have to be back before 9 in the evening, and you can't have whiskey on your breath, or Mrs. Sullivan will turn her back to you, and the hard pavement of the nickel will be your pillow. But back in the day. Oh, back in the day. The Regency House. The Regency House sat on Central Park West and had a lot of kids from SNL living in it. Kevin Nealon, Phil Hartman, Timmy Meadows, even the great Adam Sandler. And Laurie Jo Hoekstra. Laurie Jo was a writer's assistant who got me into the joint. It was great to move out of Central Park Zoo. Polar bears make for terrible neighbors. Laurie Jo was the smartest and funniest woman I had ever met. And she was hotter than a $2 pistol to boot. She eventually became my producer on Weekend Update, and then my producing partner on everything thereafter. Truth be told, any success I ever attained would have been impossible without Laurie Jo. I lived way up on the 35th floor of the Regency House and had a beautiful view of the wall of another 35th floor of another New York apartment building. We were a stone's throw away from work, and I'd often walk there with Sandler, who everyone knew and loved. The doorman, Steve, always had a good word for Adam and liked to talk to him about the show from the week before. Sometimes he liked it, and sometimes he didn't, but he always loved Adam. Adam introduced me to Steve and told him that I was on the show as well. Steve looked puzzled, and I explained that, although I was technically on the show, I had yet to actually be on the TV. Steve looked even more puzzled. "Well, you don't worry, Steve," Sandler said. You'll be seeing plenty of Normie." That's all it took. After that, I was good with Steve. One day, I left my apartment and got in the elevator. There was a girl standing in it. Her head was bent down, and she quietly wept. So I ignored her. On the 21st floor, a man got on the elevator. He was a real gregarious, New York kind of guy. As soon as he saw the girl, he jumped into action. "Hey, honey, what's the matter?" he asked. And she mumbled through sniffles, to which he replied, "Let me tell you something. Everything's going to turn out all right, okay? This guy knows." And he motioned to me. But I didn't know, so I stayed silent. We all got out of the elevator, and I went to get my mail, and when I got back to the lobby, the gregarious fellow was still talking to the girl, who was still quietly weeping. He was telling her how things always worked out, how matters that were substantial today were trivial tomorrow. He told her that he would take her to have coffee in the Greek diner around the corner, and that everything was going to be just fine. And she nodded as they left. On my way back up to my apartment, I was spotted by Steve, the doorman. His eyes were bright and he smiled. I knew why. He had seen me on the show the previous Saturday. It was my first time on screen. Tim Herlihy had put me in a Star Trek sketch where I had one line, "Beam me up, Scotty." That was good enough for Steve, the doorman. "Hey, hey, look who it is. Beam me up, Scotty. How you feeling this fine morning, beam me up, Scotty?" I'm good, Steve. Real good. I'm going to go upstairs to my apartment, have a cigarette and coffee, and read the daily news." "Attaboy, beam me up, Scotty," said Steve the doorman. From then on, that was how Steve the doorman knew me. When I got home from work, I could always rely on a hearty, "Good evening to you, beam me up, Scotty." He was always excited to see me, because I was a famous guy who went on the TV every Saturday night and said, "Beam me up, Scotty." The problem was, only he and I knew that, and everyone in the vicinity would just look at me, awed. One time I was going through the door and Steve was having a conversation with a friend, which he abruptly stopped when he saw that such a famous figure as I was at the door. "Hey, beam me up, Scotty. I'd like you to meet a friend of mine, John. He's a good guy. Always been there for me, you know what I mean? You don't find that often in this life. John, I'd like you to meet... Beam me up, Scotty." John shook my hand and said, "Sorry, what was your name?" Steve got embarrassed that his friend was so ignorant of popular culture, and he slapped the back of his glove on the chest of John's heavy coat and reproached him. "What's the matter with you, Johnny? This is Beam Me Up Scotty from the TV." Then he looked at me. "Go ahead, do it for him." "Beam me up, Scotty," I said. John just looked at me for a long moment, bewildered, and then said, "Oh, yeah, sure, I know you." "Sure you know him," Steve said. "He's Beam Me Up Scotty." And outside the Regency House, we all laughed loudly for different reasons in the cold autumn of New York. A little fame can be an embarrassing thing, and I was to learn that lesson often. I mean, I'm used to it now, like when Mr. Abernathy says, "Hey, Biscopo, that stew's not all for you, you know." Mr. Abernathy, he's lived at the boarding house forever, and when I first moved in, he called me Piscopo, and I never corrected him. I should have years ago, but if you don't do something right away, you never do it. And after all, one name is as good as another. One time, that first year on SNL, I got recognized by an actual celebrity. It was Slash, whom I had admired for some time, both for his incredible guitar playing and his hat. It would never occur to me that a guy like Slash would even know a bum like me existed. But that's the great thing about showbiz. A famous guy like Slash, whom you've never met in your life, runs up to you in the streets of New York, shakes your hand, and treats you like you're both old friends. "How you doing, buddy? What's new?" "Oh, not much, Slash. Just same old. You know how it is. Hurry up and wait." Yeah, don't I know it. When you're in showbiz, and you meet another guy in showbiz, you're supposed to play it cool. But me, I get real nervous. Slash asked if we could speak in confidence, and so we found a corner where we could talk and be unheard by the unfamous. Slash leaned into me close. "Have you talked to Chucky lately?" I didn't know anyone named Chucky. Not for a while, no, I said. "Why?" Slash got even quieter. "He's not in good shape." "When was the last time you talked to him?" I felt sweat everywhere. I don't know. Probably 4 months. He seemed pretty good, considering." I knew I had to get out of there quickly, before Slash realized I was not who I was pretending to be. A close friend of his who shared a mutual friend named Chucky with him. Chucky, who was not in good shape. But I could hardly just run away. "Listen," said Slash, "if you have a chance and could go see him, it'd mean the world to him. Like I said, he's not in good shape. Although I guess, knowing Chucky, that shouldn't come as a big surprise." "No," I said meaningfully, "it sure shouldn't." And then I shook my head sadly, and so did Slash. I still think of Chucky from time to time. I like to hope Chucky's doing better. But knowing Chucky, as I do by pretending to know Chucky, chances aren't good. Oh, and that girl who was quietly sobbing on the elevator? I saw her again, but only once, and it was the damnedest thing. It was months later, and I entered the elevator, and there she was. Except this time she wasn't alone. She was with the gregarious guy, the guy I'd seen console her months earlier. But now he wasn't consoling her. He was yelling at her and telling her she had no business looking through his drawers. Her head was bent down, and she quietly wept.
Years ago, I was friends with Andy Warhol and was present when he uttered his prophetic statement, "In the future, everybody will be famous for 15 minutes." Andy did not live to see his words take shape in our world. I work in the following manner. I listen to my subject, and I absorb all he has to say. When I discover his essence, I become him. My process is the same that Lee Strasberg teaches actors. You could call it method writing, I suppose. I had Mr. McDonald over to my brownstone for an afternoon tea, and he stayed a month. It was the longest month of my life as I listened to what he called his great antidotes. These were either dishwater-dull true stories or preposterous lies. He wrote The Jerk for Steve Martin. He was Canada's Minister of Defense. He used to like Brussels sprouts, but not anymore. I'm still afraid to enter my guest room, which is filled knee-high with his SNL jackets, Norm Show t-shirts, and dirty work hats. And, hiding among his laundry, hypodermic needles. Now he phones me and I leave the poor answering machine to listen. But still, I remain confident that I will find the truth of the man, which will then enable me to become him. I am determined to make Mr. McDonald appear interesting, engaging, and most of all, funny. This last bit is the most difficult task, because the man is simply not funny. Fortunately, I have a razor-sharp sense of humor, always have. Here's an example of what I find humorous. A professor of history buys a dog, and a colleague asks, "Have you thought of a name for the beast?" "Why, certainly," says the professor. "I was thinking of naming it the Holy Roman Empire." "But why?" asks his bewildered friend. "Well, it's really quite simple," replies the history professor. "You see, the dog is neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire." I should say I recounted this joke to Mr. McDonald at an early meeting and was answered with the blankest of stares. Pearls before swine. But my opinions are meaningless because in this upside-down world, Mr. McDonald is famous and I am not. In the future, everyone will be anonymous for 15 minutes.